Well, what do you think? Kind of like, I remember when I first heard this, I read it, chanting, I thought, this makes absolutely no sense to me. Kind of like something written by Timothy Leary, he's on an acid trip or something. And yet, this is chanted regularly in the Soto Zen monasteries. So, Kate and I, with trepidation, but also with a little bit of enthusiasm, thought, let's explore this and see what we can bring forward from this poem. So last week, Kate introduced this song of the Jewel Mir Samadhi, giving some of the background, and talking also a little bit about the great Chinese Zen teacher, Dongshan, who is considered to be the author of this poem. Although there's lots of dispute, especially in academic circles, about who actually wrote it and when it was written and the usual kind of things that for us are really not that important at all. Because for us it really doesn't matter whether Dongshan is the author or not. But what can be helpful are the stories about Dongshan's life that I think Kate talked some about last week, and practice. And I think also what this particular poem, this song of the Jewel Mir Samadhi, may show us or tell us about our own life and situation, and how we are connected to this world. As I mentioned, this poem is chanted in Zen temples daily in Japan, and also chanted at Zen temples in North America. Not daily, but you know, kind of a cycle. It's chanted regularly. It's considered to be a great teaching, and honored both in Japan and here as a kind of illustrating the view of reality that awakens from, or that arises from, an awakened heart. But of course, the original is in Chinese. And Chinese is very hard to translate into a language like English for many reasons. But particularly, this is old Chinese, like ancient language, which makes it a little harder. And to make it even more complicated and harder, the Zen tradition has always tried to avoid clarity. You don't want to be clear. Because if it's clear, you think, oh yeah, I understand, I got it, then there's a problem. Because immediately you're kind of fixed onto it. Now I got it, right? Now I get it. Last week, Kate began exploring this poem, looking at the first five stanzas after talking a bit about the author and all that. And these first five stanzas are quite beautiful. They use some very lovely images, I think, kind of illustrating the relative and the absolute, this kind of everyday world we have, and then something more, something that kind of binds, holds. I sometimes think of it as there's kind of a strange dichotomy of our life and the world, both being full of distinctions and objects, and yet in the same moment being unified and whole. And of course, we so live in this world of separateness, so caught in this world of separateness that we forget. At the same time, Everything is intimately connected and whole. In the Chinese religious philosophy, traditionally night or the dark is symbolic of unity. Has a kind of that strong positive sense of unity and wholeness. Since in the dark, all forms that we see, all the colors and the shapes, can no longer be seen, right? They fade and disappear in the dark. And in the day, in Chinese philosophy again, light represents the relative world. We see all the forms, all the distinctions, it's very clear. And we think that's it most of the time, right? That's it. There was a famous philosopher and sociologist named Alfred Schultz, American. I think he's kind of the first guy that at least I'm aware of. He proposed the idea that we live in two worlds. One world, we think of the everyday world, right? You know, kind of get up, brush our teeth, all these distinctions that we have. We have our coffee, et cetera, et cetera. But he says, you know, often unnoticed or we don't pay attention to, we slip into other worlds, other times in our daily life. Like, you know, we listen to music. We read a really interesting book or novel. We watch the Canucks on TV, and suddenly time takes on a different meaning, and we enter a kind of a slightly different space, even in those kind of simple daily activities. And then we dismiss it. Well, you know, not really important. Not really true. It's, you know. But he says, and he points out, no, that no one can stand to live in the everyday world for very long. Right? Before long, we have to find a way out. And I think, in a way, that's true, because most of the time we have forgotten or we forget this sense of intimacy that we share with everything. Which is at the very heart of this dual mirror samadhi poem. So I'm going to pick up where Kate left off. So I think this, if you have the handout, it's verse 6, listed on the handout, verse 6. But if you don't, on the book, it's, although it is not fabricated, it is not without speech. It is like facing a jewel mirror. Form and image behold each other. So although it is not fabricated, it is not without speech. Now, in Chinese language, as I said, can be very challenging to translate. It says here without speech, but another way you could translate that is beyond words. So although it's not fabricated, it's not beyond words. So another way to translate this. So it is not fabricated. The it here refers to the jewel mirror, or which represents the kind of absolute or the boundless nature of things. The jewel mirror, or this absolute, is unconstructed, unmade, unconditioned. This is how it's understood in the Buddhist terms, unconditioned. It is not fabricated. This other part, this part of a reality that we often are blind to. It is not beyond words, though. And that's interesting. Because from the very beginning of the Zen tradition, you know, many teachers and many kind of adepts, you know, in the Zen tradition have always cautioned against just studying and using the rational mind to try awaken, to try really deeply understand the nature of who we are. And even the mythical founder of Zen Buddhism, Bodhidharma, who was said to be the man who brought the Zen tradition from India or from the kind of northern part of India, it wasn't called India at that time, but from there into China. And, you know, we have writings supposedly left by him. And anyway, he left this verse as a kind of caution against, you know, relying on the intellect, relying on the written words. And he said, this tradition, this is about the Zen tradition, a special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence upon words and letters, directly pointing to the mind of man, seeing into one's own nature and awakening. So not relying on what we read in books or what people tell us, but to actually look deeply into our own nature, look deeply into our own mind and awaken, this Bodhidharma's caution. And yet here in the Song of the Jewelmere Samadhi, Dongshan tells us words and speech are not outside the Absolute either. This Absolute, this unconditioned, is not somehow beyond words, or maybe words are not necessarily outside it, is how I'd like to think of it. In an earlier line in the poem, the earlier line says, the meaning is not in the words. So in other words, don't get hooked on the language, right? But also don't think language is, I think he's saying at this line here, don't think also that language is somehow outside, that we throw it away. It's not necessary, not connected. Dongshan said, don't do that either. Don't hang on and don't throw away. I think at this point in this poem, it is not without speech. It's suggesting that this Absolute is also not separate from language. Language is not something that we need to avoid. And perhaps, maybe another way to say this, it's implying that words can be like a finger pointing at the moon. Very famous Zen image, right? A finger pointing at the moon. We surely do need to take care not to become infatuated with the finger or the words, right? Get these, you know, two guys saying, it says right here this. What do you say? Oh, look over here, it says this. And no. You know, don't get infatuated with the finger, thinking that it's the moon. And yet, the finger does offer us direction. And used wisely, seeing that it's just an indication, it may help us come to actually see the moon. So the poem goes on. It is like facing jewel mirror, form and image behold each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. Aren't mirrors magical? When I was a kid, I loved mirrors. And I remember in the bathroom, we had one of those wall mirrors where, you know, medicine cabinet mirrors where the mirrors would go like this, right? You have these two open up. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to say this, but time and time again, I would go up and like open the mirrors like this, right? I'd stand on the counter and look and see these infinite row of Michaels looking back at me, right? I thought that was so cool. over and over again. I really enjoyed that. And certainly in the stories, both in Asia and here in the West, mirrors are said to have magical powers, right? They have these special powers. In the Chinese tradition of feng shui, for example, does everybody know feng shui? Yeah. Kind of importance of where you place things in the house to channel energies. And so in the Chinese tradition of feng shui, mirrors, when they're placed in the appropriate position, can amplify good energies. But if they're placed in the wrong position, they amplify the negative energy. So you got to be careful where you place your mirrors. And of course, in children's stories that most of us grew up with in the West, mirrors can tell us where other people are. They can tell us who is the most beautiful. And at times, they can be doorways into other worlds. Babies recognize themselves in a mirror, recognize that they're reflected in a mirror at about 18 months. Does that ring right for you, do you think?
Well, he's only 15 months.
Oh, he's got a couple more months to go, right?
I'll hold him onto the mirror when I get home.
So. Right, see if he says, oh, it's me.
I'll report back in 2 months.
That'd be great. And a variety of animals, of course, like including, of course, the apes, but also elephants, dolphins, orcas, and magpies can also be aware that the image they see is a reflection of themselves. I think humans in all cultures have been so fascinated with mirrors and anything that reflects our image because we can see then what is always hidden from us. We can see our own face. Dongzhan points out that our practice is like this. Through Zazen, through the meditation practice, through the mindfulness, you know, that we practice in our daily life, we come to see that which is usually hidden from our view. We come to see that there is more than just the separate, particular, distinct forms. Form and image behold each other. And isn't that exactly what it feels like when we look into a mirror? Before us appears another person. We lift a hand and touch our cheek to check, is this indeed our image, or is that like one of those strange mirrors? There's somebody else there, right? Kind of, oh, yeah. I think we do this when we look in a mirror, you know, and kind of like check, is it really me? Because we are in the presence of a mystery. And the image appears just as interested and as slightly astonished as we may feel when we look into a mirror. Right? And even now, when looking into the bathroom mirror, the image and I are both surprised about how much the other has aged. You are not it. In truth, it is you. Next little line. Now, this short sentence refers back to a story of Dongshan's awakening that Kate talked about last week. So just briefly, Dongshan, after years of training in China, left his teacher, Yunyan, and went to go on a traveling, on a trip, a kind of pilgrimage, as was very common practice by Chinese monks in those days. And he left, pondering Nunyan's final words to him. he had asked Yunyan for some, you know, words about awakening, like, you know, tell me the essence of your teaching. And Yunyan's final words to him were, just this is it. Now, probably like, certainly like me and maybe like you, Dongshan at first didn't really understand what Yunyan had just said to him. What do you mean, just this is it? So near the start of his journey, Yunyan maybe was pondering this, and he crossed a slow-moving stream and looked down and saw his reflection. And, according to the story, awakened to the meaning of his teacher's last words to him. Just this is it. Everyday life and boundless reality are not two. Everyday life and boundless reality are not two. And now in our minds we may understand this to some extent, right? Maybe. Like, I kind of picture it in my mind kind of like the pieces that form a kind of ecological system. You know, you need the frogs and the water and the plants and what?
Mosquitoes,
you know. We need this whole system, right? It's kind of like, is it like that? But Dongshan and the ancestors in this poem and in the other teachings ask us to go further beyond that, seeing it as pieces that are connected to each other. You are not it. In truth, it is you. Awareness of this skin bag of Michael, with all his memories, views, and imaginings, is not it. Is not absolute. When I look at it from that point of view. And yet, these two, these memories, views, and images are permeated with boundless reality. Boundless reality, as Kate explained last week, is called tatata in Sanskrit, tatata, and often translated as thusness or suchness in English. And this is what the jewel mirror symbolizes in the poem, this boundless reality, this tatata, this suchness. The absolute nature, the boundlessness of everything. And the poem itself, over and over again, Dongshan tries to illuminate the tension between the self or objects and the intimate interrelatedness of everything. That goes even further than my kind of simple image of a pond, an ecology. Poem continues. Like a babe in the world in five aspects complete, it does not go or come, nor rise, nor stand. Baba Wawa. I'm so glad I got to say this, this part of the poem. Is anything said or not? Ultimately, it does not apprehend anything because its speech is not yet correct. These five aspects has also been translated as five senses. Although in traditional understanding of Buddhism, we have six senses: touch, hearing, seeing, taste, smell. And mind. The traditional understanding of Buddhism is that the mind can be considered a sense as well, and or the sixth sense, and thoughts are like the object of that sense. So it's just kind of another way of categorizing things, I guess. So one understanding of this, like a babe in the world and the five aspects complete, may be the full childlike openness to the world, like a babe, free of judgment and discrimination, before we start parsing and separating things. And it's just the world fully flowing in and through the senses. In another book, or another kind of Zen collection of teachings called the Blue Cliff Record, in case 80, let's call it chapter 80 of this collection of teachings, there's a monk, these are lots of stories, a monk asks another famous teacher, Zhao Zhou, about babies and their senses. You know, in Zen we investigate everything. You know, we investigate everything. So he asked Zhao Zhou, you know, what about babies and their senses? What can you tell me about that? And Zhao Zhou replies in part this. Through her eyes, though her eyes can see and her ears can hear, she does not discriminate among the six sense objects. Got it so far? Little baby, right? It's not saying, oh, now I'm seeing, now I'm hearing, now I'm tasting. It's just taste, just seeing, no discrimination. At this time, she knows nothing of good and evil, superior and inferior, right and wrong, gain and loss. A student of the way must become again like an infant. Then one cannot be moved by praise or blame, success or fame, trial or ease. Although though one sees forms, one is the same as blind. Though one hears sounds, one is the same as deaf. He is like a fool, like an idiot. Again, another famous Zen expression, using fool and idiot to mean, how delightful this moment, no matter what it is. So does that make sense? You know, it's like, this is good coffee. Can you say that every time you have a sip of coffee? Just, or is it like, this is good, that's not good. This is okay, this is too cold. I have a lot to practice with this, because I'm one of those guys who enjoy what I call a good cup of coffee. Although I've had really bad coffee. My keto teacher in Japan, I haven't told you the story, I'm sure I've told some people. He would make, when I first went to Japan, a young guy in Japan with my keto teacher, he would make instant Nescafe, like in a tea bowl. And then he would put in several spoonfuls of powdered creamer called Creep. And then some black syrup concoction he made up with Chinese herbs, and stir it all up and give it to me as a special treat. Usually about 11 o'clock at night. So I was like a fool or an idiot. At least I didn't say anything. Just drank it down. But what the poem is saying here, and Zhao Zhou's is saying, is about babies. In the field of thusness, in this absolute, in this place of the jewel mirror of unity, what is there to discriminate against or for? And how can any comparison be made? Just like a newborn babe cannot go or come, stand, or rise up, thusness too has no changing position. but remains always whole and complete. Baba Wawa is anything said or not. Ultimately, it does not apprehend anything because its speech is not yet correct, for words are not yet correct. Or another translation, for words are not accurate. The various sutras or writings left to us from the ancient teachers are full of illustrations and explanations describing the jewel mirror or describing thusness. But just like the sounds from a baby, just as those sounds really have very little meaning to us, right? As a young baby cooing. The many teachings cannot really tell us what our Buddha nature truly is. Again, like fingers pointing at the moon. But nonetheless, these explanations are the fingers pointing at the moon, right? They can be helpful. And the teachers of old, out of their compassion, tried to speak and to leave us signs to help us on our own way. They know what they experienced, but there's no way they can say it so that we too can fully understand. Words fail to reveal the absolute because our mind and language are limited and cannot express the inconceivable. Oh, goodness, I'm taking so long. It's like the six lines of the illumination hexagram. Relative and ultimate interact. Piled up, they make three. The complete transformation makes five. Well, this is pretty clear. We could just skip on and go on to the next. Okay. So, the hexagram comes from the I Ching, the Book of Changes, a classic Zen text, Chinese text, that originally started as a tool of divination and still has that function today for some people. But it also evolved into a really interesting philosophical text that offers a way to understand how the universe operates. So the text, the I Ching, is made up of commentaries on 64 hexagrams, made up of combinations of six solid lines and broken lines. So this is the example of the one that he's talking about here, right? Okay, thanks. So the illumination hexagram is composed of what they call the Li or fire trigram, which is doubled to form the hexagram, right? So they see these two things. So the Li trigram is associated with mind and clarity. And the lower is said to represent the inner, while the upper is said to represent the outer. And this is true of all of the hexagrams. So we could think of it, one part of it illuminating the inside, one part illuminating the outside. But as one scholar suggested that I find very interesting, this hexagram operates like a mirror. The top and the bottom trigrams are the same. Got that? There's so much complex and kind of esoteric literature about the hexagrams, and we don't really need to go into it to appreciate the poem, but just again to see this as a kind of symbol of the relative and the absolute, right? Both there, both reflecting the nature of reality. So it's like the taste of the five-flavored herb, like a diamond thunderbolt. Now here, Dongshan offers us some more examples of kind of the again mutuality and identity. The five-flavored herb refers to a plant, and scholars kind of debating which plant it was, but apparently has five flavors of sweetness, bitterness, saltiness, kind of acidicness, and acridness. And the diamond thunderbolt is in Sanskrit called a vajra, or in Tibetan a dorje, and it's a ritual instrument that's used in Vajrayana, or kind of tantric schools of Buddhism. And it usually has three or else five prongs, although I think there's other variations as well. But again, symbolizing this idea of one and many. One and many is what he's trying to get at. Together, a unity of both. And you may have noticed five appearing quite a bit in this last little bit of the poem here. And these are references to five stages of awakening that Dongshan also goes on about, but we don't really need to talk about that tonight. Let's go on to the poem just a little bit more. Subtly included within the true, inquiry and response come up together. What is subtly included in the true? And the Zen tradition describes the distance between awakening and delusion almost as thin as a sheet of paper. Or as Dogen, actually I think I'll skip that part. The understanding is that what we have lost, or what we need to be complete, has always been right here. And in practicing the way, we rediscover the already existing harmony between the relative and the absolute, between the many and the one, between life and death, between the myriad things and boundlessness. So intimate and so close are these seeming realities, it is as if inquiry and response come up together at the same moment. Communing with the source, traveling the pathways, embracing the territory, and treasure the road. Well, I think this line is saying, you know, practice and our awakening are not two things to us. Our practice and our awakening are the same. In fact, when I looked at the Chinese, this communing and travel uses the same Chinese word for both those. It's a kind of paradox. The way, the practice, the source is all pervading. It's everywhere. And yet we also need the challenge of practice. We are not newly born babes, free of judgment and discrimination, not free of strong reactions and impulses that come from our ego. And yet, if we take up the view that our practice is a kind of self-help project, like all the other self-help projects we've tried throughout our life, that we're going to somehow make ourselves better, then we're already mired knee-deep in mud. The ego, our mind, can so quickly create the dichotomy of the jewel mirror being somewhere else. It's not here. It's somewhere else, and I'll have to like do something to get to it. Right? My goal now is I'm going to get that jewel mirror. I'm going to get the awakening. Dongshan cautions us, the source and the pathways are all included within the true. We just become intimate with the territory and the road. We become intimate with our life. So, I've gone a bit longer than I thought. I mean, I'll just sum up. What do I think this poem holds for us or for me? As I read this over, I took away kind of two things. How can I become more aware of the interactions of my everyday, in my interactions of my everyday life with everything that surrounds me? How do I become intimate with the what I think is the non-Michael? Where does Michael begin and where does Michael end? I don't know. But those are things that I want to carry with me from reading this part of the poem. And I realize we have 10 minutes left. And so, and this is supposed to be a class, not me yammering on. So I'd like to suggest this. Take a partner. Just one person to talk with. And I'd like you, I'll time you. I'll give you like about 3 minutes each to talk about this. Where, when are you most complete, most whole? And what's that like for you, to really feel whole and complete? Where and when does that happen for you? And how might you cultivate more of that? Just being whole and complete. Beyond, you know, doing zazen practice, of course. Okay?
Included.
Yes. But, you know, you can mention that, but also, well, how else might you do that? So, please just find the person beside you, introduce yourselves, so you have a name. Don't be shy. Just... Does everyone have a part? Let me know if anyone has a partner. If Kate wants to make tea. We need...
Do we have any odd numbers?
We have one group of three.
That's it, yeah. That's, there can be one group of three.
Okay.